Super Talk Mississippi Media Production.
Well, welcome, everyone, to True American Heroes for the Record. And today we're honored to have with us Mr. Charles Ferg, who is actually from the Hazelhurst community. But he's got a very unique distinction that I'm just proud to meet this gentleman. 31 and a half years, is that correct, Charles?
That's correct.
31 and a half years in the United States Marine Corps.
Hurrah.
Hurrah. Semper Fi. Well, it's an honor to have you here. We are looking forward to this conversation. I don't honestly think I have ever met a gentleman who served that length of time in the Corps. But it is an honor to have you with us today.
Thank you.
All right. Well, let's just get right into this. I think it was interesting. We were talking a moment ago, and you were telling me a little bit how you got exposed to the Marines. And it started out as a really young chap.
Roger that. I was caddying on a golf course that was right across the street from the Marine Corps Reserve Center in Johnstown, Pennsylvania, where I'm from. And I was hanging out just kind of watching what was going on, and they invited me to come in, and eventually I started working with them, and I was cleaning machine guns and rifles and pistols. And the funniest thing, though, was one day they said, "Do you want to buff the deck?" And I said, "Sure." I never did it before. This was a huge buffer because the parade deck inside this building was big. And so I grabbed a hold of it, and that thing took off, and I was hanging on for dear life. And the whole INI staff was sitting off to the side, just laughing their heads off.
That's funny, because they are hard, unless you know the technique. A buffer has got a mind of its own.
Roger
now,
that.
You just said something that was interesting. The Marine Corps is a separate branch of the United States military, but they're closely affiliated with the Navy.
Roger that.
Okay. And I noticed you used an interesting word, because you didn't say the floor. You said the deck. Now, that's kind of a Navy term, but yet because the Marines are so much a part of the Navy and the Navy a part of the Marines, missions very, very, you know, close to one another and together, you used a lot of naval terms in the Marine Corps.
All the time.
And deck, as you would be referring to the deck of a ship, is what you guys called the inside of a building in the core.
Yeah, and the ceiling would be an overhead, and the walls would be bulkheads.
Bulkheads. That's so neat. All right, so you kind of, I'm sure that was for a youngster. How old did you say you were?
I was 15 and 16.
Okay. That had to be quite a rush. I mean, that was exciting to be around those Marines, especially them letting you do some of the things. Of course, we couldn't do that today, but back then we could do that kind of thing, and that built up kind of probably had a kind of motivated you toward the future.
Let me tell you another story about that. So when I turned 17, I wanted to enlist in the reserves. Mm-hmm. And so both parents had to sign that.
That's right.
And my dad signed, my mother wouldn't. And so I brought the recruiter home, and she was so embarrassed that he was there that she signed just to get rid of him.
So you actually got into the reserves at 17?
Yep, 2 weeks after my 17th birthday.
Awesome. Well, was it something that you were – that was a lifelong dream, I guess, even though you'd only been around him a couple of years?
No, it really wasn't. It wasn't until I had gotten over there and was working as a youngster.
Yeah, yeah.
And I just wanted to be part of it. But one of the things that's interesting now, then, that would never happen now, is that organizations would call us and have us come out and do live fire demonstrations. And we would take two machine guns, and back then I was a BAR man, and they'd take a rifle. Mm-hmm. And the heavy machine gun was one of those water-cooled machine guns.
Oh, yeah.
And the staff sergeant that was shooting that would intentionally pick a tree that was about 8 to 10 inches in diameter and cut it down with that machine gun. But Boy Scout troops, VFWs, American Legions, we'd do it for any of them.
And so about what year would that have been? So we'd have a reference point there.
Let's see. I went in 57. I went to boot camp in 58 because I was still in high school.
Okay.
So I was on what they called the delayed entry program.
Right, right.
And so
that would have been 60, around?
59.
59 or 60.
Yeah.
Awesome. All right, well, we got to talk. You know, we got to talk about the legendary basic training for the Marine Corps. I've heard it called a lot of things, and a lot of those things we're not going to say on the air. But I've had some good friends who went through it years ago, older gentlemen like myself, and some young men who have been through it in the last few years. And it is, to say the least, grueling, demanding, where they tear you down and build you back. Is that pretty close, or how would you describe it?
See,
I had
already been in the Marines for a year before I went to boot camp. And I actually went to boot camp as a PFC, which nobody else does.
Okay.
But so I knew what to expect. I got my hair cut short before I went. And as a result, I already knew how to march.
Mm-hmm.
And I was selected as the section leader and the right guide,
are
prestigious positions.
Right.
So I was far ahead of anybody else in that platoon, and it wasn't that difficult.
That's the first time I've ever heard that. You must have been a tough little fella, because it is a grueling, sir.
Yeah, well, people warned me and told me what to expect.
That's right. You've been
surprised.
Exposed to the Marine Corps for over a year by that time.
Right.
Okay.
So and I was real active in my reserve unit.
Okay.
Because they had known me for a couple of years. So I was on the color guard.
Oh.
I was on their weapons demonstration team.
Color guard is the gentleman that's usually, what is it? Is it five men?
Four.
Four men.
American flag.
Marine Corps flag. And two riflemen. Yeah. That's a very prestigious thing to be selected for the color guard. Okay. So Parris Island, where the basic training takes place. And while you're there, I know it's a lot of physical training. There's a lot of mental testing, and they're evaluating. Did you know before you went to Parris Island kind of what the Marine Corps was going to do with you? Of course, everybody in the Marine Corps goes through infantry training, but then they specialize based on capabilities and skills.
Right.
How did that progress for you?
Well, I was what they call an 03 rifleman, infantry MOS. And so all my training up to the point where I went on active duty and went into aviation was all based on infantry. And I loved it. I mean, my daddy was a BAR man in World War I.
Oh, my.
And I was a BAR man in 1957.
That's awesome. That's an awesome story.
And actually, I just bought one.
Get out of here. I was going to ask you, when you were doing your infantry training before they issued, or you're selected to be a BAR operator, were they still using the M1 Garands?
Yes.
Finest weapon, I think, ever made for what it accomplished and how it served in World War II and post-World War II, Korea as well, I think. So
yeah, I had fired expert in boot camp, and when I got home, they put me on the rifle team. So I was shooting competition.
The M1 Garand was an awesome weapon. And now you bought your own BAR to hang on the wall or lock it up in the safe?
It sits on the floor.
How heavy? BAR was pretty heavy.
It's 21 pounds.
And you guys didn't carry your weapon and ammo.
Yeah.
Did you carry both?
Oh, yeah.
I thought we had a separate. No, that was. Okay, I'm thinking about
had,
the
you
other.
You had an assistant BAR man who carried ammunition.
That's right. Ooh. Okay, so the Browning automatic rifle is an awesome weapon as well. It's hard to. Somebody told me you don't really aim it, you just point it and pull the trigger.
Well, the key is just tap the trigger. And just tapping the trigger gets you three rounds downrange.
Wow. Wow.
It's fairly accurate. When I fired it, I was 120 pounds back then. And so I had to put sandbags on the bipod in front to keep it from moving.
Yeah. And it did have a tripod, didn't it?
A bipod, excuse me.
Yeah, bipod. I'd forgotten about that. Man, this is neat. Okay, so you're in the Corps. What was your first base assignment?
Well, I went back to Johnstown.
So that's where you were?
Yeah. And my neighbor across the alley from where I lived was a Korean War vet. And he said, Charlie, he says, you can't make a living as an 03. You got to learn a trade. And so he convinced me to go into aviation.
Okay.
And so I went on active duty in 1959 and went to Millington, Tennessee, yeah, to the aviation school system.
Yeah, yeah.
And when I got there, they put me in what they called the AQ school, which was Airborne Missile Control Systems. And so that was my MOS.
Okay.
And it turned out to be a critical MOS that I could not get out of as
well,
much as I tried.
It got real busy over the next 10, 20 years. Because you're talking about now in the early 60s, and we're progressing toward Vietnam. Now, pretty incredible story you shared earlier. You actually had three deployments in Vietnam, in the Marine Corps. And all three, you volunteered to go.
Oh, yeah. I couldn't wait.
Was
I
that,
mean, Marines trained to go
it is
to
a,
the war.
It's a combat unit. That's what they're designed to do. Yeah, that's
and
most
I
of the Marines I've
done. And I hate to sit back and not be able to participate.
To serve. So, let's talk about the first deployment. I believe you said that was 1965, correct?
Correct.
All right. Tell us about what you, where you were and what you did in 19. That first, was it 2 years, 1 year?
It was a one-year deployment.
Gotcha.
And it was a normal rotational deployment.
Gotcha.
We went to Atsugi, Japan first, and we stayed there, and we were staging to go to Vietnam. Mm-hmm. And we were sitting there all packed up for 3 months. And finally, they said, it's time to go. And I don't know what, but anyhow, they told us the Air Force was going to fly us in on C-141s,
mm-hmm,
which are a lot bigger than a Marine Corps C-130.
Yeah.
At the last minute, they changed it to the Marines 130s, and all our pallets had to be broken down and put into smaller.
Resized. Yep.
Yep. And so we went. Unfortunately, stuff got all mixed up, and it didn't come in the priorities that it should have.
So you flew into, where was you? Where
Da
Nang.
You
guys?
We went to Da Nang, yes.
Okay. And this was a Marine aviation group.
Marine Fighter Squadron.
And you were flying at that time what aircraft?
F-4Bs.
F-4Bs?
It turns out when we got there that they didn't need fighters. They needed bombers. Well, the Phantom carries a lot of bombs. In fact, we ran the bomb dump out of bombs at one time.
How many aircraft were in your...
We had 18.
18. And that's a two-man ship.
Yep.
Pilot and weapons?
No, they call it a RIO. Radar operator,
that's
radar
right.
intercept operator,
that's right.
Officer.
Kind of a defensive thing. All right, so you're in Da Nang, and you're keeping them in the air. How many missions were you guys flying?
Oh, all the time.
Nighttime missions?
Yeah. I mean, we could watch our planes dropping the bombs. They were that close to the base.
I bet that was interesting.
Yeah.
So they didn't have far to go to get fuel and or weapons.
Nope.
Good gracious life.
The other side of that was that since they didn't need the radar, they took the radar shop and they made us the camp guard. And I was the sergeant of the guard.
So you were back carrying a weapon again, and
yeah,
instead of working on aircraft as you had been trained. But
yeah,
that's typical military. You,
somebody had
need.
To do it.
Somebody's
got to
do it, and where the need is where you put your men. All right, we're going to take a short break, and we'll be back in just a minute with Mr. Charles Ferg from Hazelhurst, Mississippi, and a member of the United States Marine Corps for 31 and a half years.
College baseball is back. Your favorite teams in the best matchups of the season. And nobody covers America's pastime like Sports Talk Mississippi. Afternoons on Super Talk Mississippi.
Welcome back. We're honored to have with us Mr. Charles Ferg, a 31-year veteran of the United States Marine Corps. Served three deployments in Vietnam. Actually went into the Middle East, and we'll talk about that briefly. It's an honor to have you with us, Charles.
Glad to be here.
Okay, let's get right back in it. We were talking about different tours, and all of these you volunteer for because you just wanted to be in the fight naturally. So you were the first tour was in Da Nang. The second tour was on Marble Mountain, which was west of Da Nang, I believe.
Roger that.
And that was a little different aircraft. Tell us about that briefly.
When I first went there, I was a temporary commissioned officer at the time, and I went to what they called HAM 16, which is the major repair facility for the helicopters. And at this time, we had 9 helicopter squadrons, mm-hmm. which was the biggest helicopter group I think the Marine Corps has ever had. But for 6 months, I supported repairing electronic equipment for those 9 squadrons. In January of 1970, I was transferred to the 1st Cobra Squadron that the Marine Corps had, and it was HML 367. And I was assigned as the avionics weapons officer, which takes care of the guns and all the munitions that go in it. And I actually got to fly one once, test fire it. We didn't have Marine Cobras at the time. We had Army Cobras. And part of the problem there was that they had Army radios that weren't the same as Navy radios. So I had to take broken radios from our base down to what they called Red Beach, which was the Army supply base, and swap them with our bad radios. But these Cobras, unlike the Marine Cobras, which have a 20-millimeter Vulcan cannon in the nose, this one had a 40-millimeter cannon and also a minigun. Plus the rocket pods on each stub wing.
How many rockets would a pod hold?
I think 24.
Goodness. That's a lot of firepower.
Yeah.
Now, were these support missions for Marine Corps units or just
anybody?
Anybody that needed help, you guys were there to support.
The bad part was, and I think they're experiencing this now in Afghanistan and Iraq, is that under the rules of engagement, my pilots said when they got back, they needed 10 minutes to get approval to fire, and by that time the target was already gone.
Was that happening in Vietnam?
It was in the 1970.
Wow.
So I'm
what a
very
terrible
upset.
Position to put those guys in.
I mean, we're going over there to win a war, not to play games.
There's politics involved, as it often is. All right, so you've been with F-4s, now you're working with Cobras. I want to touch briefly on your experience on your third tour. I mean, you were involved in every aspect of Vietnam except jungle fighting, and you probably came as close as most did. But at the same time, that third deployment and that third mission is a part of history that a lot of people may not be aware of. Was the evacuation of Saigon right before the actual, shall we say, end of hostilities, which I don't think it really ended, but that's what the public was being told. Tell us about what it was like for the evacuation of Saigon when we said, okay, let's get our people out of there because North Vietnam is taking over.
Again, I was a first sergeant then with a rifle company, and we were on an amphibious assault ship. And we pulled into Saigon Harbor at night. And when we got up the next morning and went up on deck, there were ships from horizon to horizon, just hundreds and hundreds and hundreds of all kinds of ships. And little boats were coming out from Saigon carrying people, and we were offloading them onto all these ships. Our ship was one of the few that could land helicopters. And so there were UEs coming in, Vietnamese UEs coming in. We'd offload them, push the airplanes off the side of the ship so the next one could land. And we kept doing this for hours until they finally ran out of gas and the rest of them went in the ocean. But
goodness,
I think we were able to rescue everybody.
But and those were Vietnamese. They were American helicopters, but with Vietnamese crews trying to evacuate Vietnamese citizens and civilians.
It was generally their families of the pilots.
Trying to get them out.
And in one case, there was what we're sure is a base commander came in with greenbacks on every little pocket of his flight suit. He must have had thousands of dollars there.
Unbelievable.
The other side that was interesting was that we searched everybody primarily for weapons. But what we found was that everybody had gold bars on them.
Where'd they get those?
They had bought those before the money went bad. Because there was Vietnamese piastres everywhere, but they were worthless at that time.
Of course, they were terrified of the aspect or the idea or the possibility of the North Vietnamese and the Viet Cong taking over and the wholesale numbers of people that would have been put to death, most likely, yep. And so they were desperate to get out, and it was pretty chaotic. And I'm sure, like you said, they flew the helicopters, they ran out of fuel, and they had a ditch, and then they were able to be picked up by your smaller ships. So how long did that go on?
It went on for 3 days. And
that had to be a little bit emotional as well as just the physical demands of it.
Actually, the Vietnamese constructed little tents on our flight deck after the planes were all done. And so we had about 2,000 refugees on our ship.
Any security issues there?
After we searched everybody,
you were comfortable.
We were all right.
So how long were you actually in that area? When did y'all pull out, and where did you go from there?
We went back to Okinawa.
Back to Okinawa. How far is Okinawa from Vietnam? Is it a pretty good trip?
I can't really tell you.
That's right.
It's not that far, though.
I didn't think it was, because it's south east of Japan, so it can't be too far from you guys. Yeah. So, okay, you finish that deployment, and you're back in the States, and then you have a little bit of a time of shall we say, peace. There weren't any battles being fought around the world that we knew of. There probably was, but we just didn't know about it. So what was the next deployment? You had another one.
Yeah, we went to Beirut as part of the multinational peacekeeping force.
What year was that?
That was in 83.
That had to be a very interesting, if not extremely difficult, place to be. Did you guys have any interaction with the people?
Yeah, we did. But it was mostly the Christians.
Not the Muslim side.
No. There was 26 different factions there when
Good
we got
grief.
There.
Good.
And
grief.
They were all against each other. So we never knew who was
going to
be.
Not just one civil war, but probably about 15 or 20 civil wars going on at one time. So what were you doing? What was your assignment at that point?
I was a battalion sergeant major.
Sergeant major.
So I was, the colonel and I, we hardened our Jeep with sandbags on the floor. We turned the rear seat around. I was riding a tail gunner, and the driver was fully armed, as was the colonel. And so we would drive around because our four companies had different positions around Beirut.
Wow.
And
so I'm sure they were well secured, but that's some significant separation from where your command post was to where these outside units were. Ooh. How many guys were in those separate locations?
Usually about 120.
Okay. Now that's a significant number.
This was a battalion landing team, so we had artillery.
That's right.
Five artillery pieces. We had tanks. We had five tanks. We had everything.
Yeah, you were in a pretty good position. I didn't realize you had all of that support. So you were there how long?
We also had the New Jersey.
Oh, okay.
Set offshore.
And what size guns does the New Jersey have?
16-inch.
16-inch, and that's a range of how many miles?
Over 20.
And pretty doggone accurate. Of course, I know there's always collateral, but those weapons, even back at that time, were uncannily accurate with 16-inch, 20-mile range.
You could hear those rounds going over. It sounded like a freight train going through the sky.
That had
it was
to be
awesome.
Incredible. Incredible. Okay, so how long were you actually in Beirut?
Let's see, about 4 months.
Okay, and give me your feel. Was it like probably every other place? There were those who were glad to see you, and those that you knew, if you turned your back on them, you might be a victim.
Yeah, like I say, we didn't have much dealings with the Muslim population.
Yeah.
We dealt with the Christians when we first got there, and then really didn't have much contact with them. We had some adverse contact with the Israelis. On one occasion, the colonel and I were out go on a foot patrol with one of the companies and ran into an Israeli patrol. Mm. And they wouldn't let us pass. The colonel was talking to the State Department in Washington, D.C., and this is right on the road in Beirut. And they said, get away, let the Israelis go through you.
Oh, my word.
On another occasion, we were down on the airfield, and all of a sudden, somebody started shooting at us. It was an Israeli tank up on the hillside with a 50 caliber machine gun. And another time, an Israeli tank pulled up to one of our outposts and pointed their main gun right at our people. The funny part was the tank commander was a U.S. Army staff sergeant who had been stationed with my platoon sergeant, who was there in Ohio on recruiting duty. They knew each other. This guy was on 30 days leave. He came to Israel to fight for the Israeli army. Can you imagine that?
No, I cannot. That just blows me away. But these are some incredible stories we've been sharing today, Mr. Charles Ferg from the Hazelhurst area. But glad to have him in our radio audience. I like I said earlier, I don't think I've ever known anyone that served in the Marine Corps as long as you have. I've known some 20-year guys, 25-year guys, but I don't think I've known anybody that served 30 and a half years in the Corps. And it's an honor to have you with us today. We want to take just a moment to thank you for your service.
Thank you for recognizing that.
Well, I thank you for your service. I thank you for your sacrifice. I thank you for your willingness to do what our country needed done during those years when you gave up so much of your youth to wear the uniform of the Marine Corps, which is a great honor, as it is any of the uniforms. But Mr. Ferg, on behalf of our country and on behalf of our community, I want to say thank you for your service. Thank you for your willingness to wear that uniform and do what you did.
And
It's been an honor to have you here in the station today sharing these experiences with us.
Amen. My pleasure, too.
Thank you, sir.
A Super Talk Mississippi Media Production.